WEIF, NBC in New York.
Here is the latest news from the NBC newsroom in Chicago. For the first time in the history of their nation, the Japanese people tonight are faced with full and complete occupation. The American Third Fleet is moving through the waters of Tokyo Bay, once the most heavily mined body of water in the world. These ships of Admiral Halsey are steaming into the bay with a complement of 10,000 Marines and sailors who will occupy the Yokosuka Naval Base. The movement of these forces comes at a time when 150 American Army engineers and communications experts have landed at Atsugi Airfield, 18 miles southeast of Tokyo, in 48 American transport planes. These troops will prepare for the coming of the full airborne occupation force. Each of the American naval vessels moving into Tokyo Bay was guided by a Japanese pilot. The silent coastal guns on the Jap mainland still pointed at our ships, but evidently the breech blocks had been removed according to surrender orders. An investigation party will land at Yokosuka Naval Base to examine Jap installations before the main occupation force lands on Thursday. The American technicians at Atsugi Air Base will attempt to make the field's three short runways as safe as possible for the landing of 7,500 troops. Meantime, American correspondents and press officers have landed at Shanghai in two American planes to receive a cheering reception from the Chinese in that city. Chinese sources say the government forces have been in complete control of the city since Monday night, China time. Japanese officers took issue with the Americans in their choice of landing field near a paved highway. The Americans later went to a special airfield where the Japanese had prepared a reception ceremony. British headquarters in Rangoon, Burma, reveal that Japanese surrender envoys have affixed their names to preliminary peace agreements for the entire 200,000 Jap troops in Southeast Asia. The historic negotiations paved the way for Allied occupation of Singapore, the East Indies, and all of Southeast Asia. However, some Japanese forces on the Russian Asiatic battlefront are still putting up last-ditch resistance, and Soviet forces are said to be blowing these Jap forces to bits. At least a few Japanese are beginning to understand that they truly have lost the war, for the Tokyo radio reveals that the makers of Japanese swords are now reconverting their industries to the manufacture of, yes, plowshares, sickles, and spades. General Charles de Gaulle arrived here in Chicago tonight at the municipal airport after flying to the Windy City from New York, where he was made an honorary citizen. He told a New York audience that he is determined to make French policy conform to that of the United States. Tonight he was feted at a dinner at a Chicago hotel. A regional New England office of the War Production Board has lifted the lid on what may happen to many wartime conservation measures shortly. The regional office has sent a letter to six New England governors telling them that on September 30th, salvage of waste paper, tin, and kitchen fats will be discontinued, except as industry itself chooses to sponsor such drives. The regional board has praised the work of the citizens of these six states for their work in the conservation program and has emphasized that the turning over of such salvage work to industry is a part of the general WPB policy. Meantime, a general survey of armed forces shipping needs is being made, and pending the results of this survey, a high Washington source says the United Maritime Authority will be dissolved. This nameless source says the UMA will be dissolved by the first of next year. In other reconversion news, the War Department will follow in the steps of the Postal and Interior Departments by declaring a 40-hour week beginning September 9th. The Postal and Interior offices went on a 40-hour week today. Nazi spy Hans Rudolf Christian Zülsdorf is being held in Miami, Florida, pending transfer to some other point in the United States for questioning. Zülsdorf was picked up August 9th by British authorities at Trinidad and has been turned over to American officials. He is believed to be an associate of the two German spies, William Curtis Kolpaw and Eric Gimpel, seized in New York late last year. The entire Western Hemisphere was searched for Zülsdorf. And that's the news. This news came to you from the NBC newsroom in Chicago. Jack Gibney speaking. This is the National Broadcasting Company.
The National Broadcasting Company presents Robert St. John, author, lecturer, and world reporter, with another summary of the news and another of his famous stories about people. But before we hear from Mr. St. John, here is a brief announcement. What are you doing with your wartime savings? Uncle Sam appeals to all citizens to buy and hold more victory bonds. Since that first bond appeal at the start of hostilities, the American people have responded magnificently. Every family loaned its wartime dollars to buy a share in victory. And now the first benefits of that victory are being realized. America is preparing for peace. The Nazi and Jap schemes for world conquest have been smashed. Their generals have quit and their armies have surrendered. And many of our servicemen and women are returning to civilian life. However, our government still needs your wartime dollars. The price of total victory is enormous. Thousands of sick and wounded fighting men must be furnished with the best medical care, and millions of veterans must be helped with mustering out pay and rehabilitation benefits. Yes, purchases of victory bonds are essential to post-war America. Buy them and save them. Don't cash them in. Help your government now by investing in government victory bonds. And now, here is Robert St. John.
Good morning. This is Robert St. John speaking from the NBC newsroom in New York. At this moment, more than 100 great Allied warships ride peacefully at anchor within just 25 miles of Tokyo. Minesweepers are now at work clearing the final approaches to the island capital. But to give you the news firsthand from that part of the world, let's switch to our NBC reporter who was with that fleet. Go ahead, Joe Hainlein, on a flagship of the Third Fleet.
This is Joe Hainlein, NBC war correspondent, speaking from Sagami Bay, 50 miles south of Tokyo. The American fleet this morning lies anchored in the sheltering waters of Sagami Harbor. The big bay is literally filled with ships of every type and description, from the huge battle wagons of the Iowa and the Zulu-class, planted destroyers and landing craft. On all three sides of us, as we tug here with our anchor, we see the coast of Japan. We're barely 3 miles from the beach at our closest point. With a pair of powerful glasses, we can see tiny people traveling along the water's edge to stare in wonderment at the size of this occupation force. However, we're not at ease. Ships have been ordered to keep up sufficient steam to leave the harbor at a moment's notice. Security watches are posted topside, and the fleet maintains a strict blackout during hours of darkness. Minesweepers have been busy since before they entered the bay, sweeping a channel into Tokyo Bay. Sometime during the next 12 hours, Task Force 31 probably will detach itself from the main force and effect an entrance into Tokyo Bay. Yokosuka Peninsula, which forms the northern shore of our anchorage, is a miniature Italian beach protruding out into the Pacific. It separates Tokyo Bay from Sagami Wan. When Task Force 31 gets underway, it will round the cape and double back on its course, entering Tokyo Bay through Yuragi Strait. Rear Admiral O.C. Badger will be in command of this force. As we talked about the operation the other night, he recalled another time he approached Tokyo in this manner. That was back in 1923 when he was in command of an American Navy relief battle that went ashore at Yokohama to give aid to the population stricken in the big earthquake that year. The Admiral recalled, a bit ruefully, that he had not even received a note of thanks, either from the people he had saved or from the Japanese government. But he expects no thanks this time, because he enters as a conqueror and not as a savior. Badger probably will have another conference with the Japanese emissaries before he lands his force around to Yokosuka Naval Base. The two Jap captains who conferred with him and Rear Admiral Robert Kearney aboard the Missouri yesterday have returned to Yokosuka to carry out occupation demands. When Admiral Badger is assured that these demands have been met and the mines are swept clean, he will take his force into the bay. Badger's flagship for the moment will be the cruiser San Diego. It will lead the little flotilla, accompanied by a few minesweepers, a destroyer or two, and a troop transport. Aboard this transport will be a battalion of Marines, whose job will be to secure three small islands in the bay opposite Yokosuka. On August 29th, the main body of the fleet will also enter the bay. There it will remain in readiness for another day, awaiting the actual occupation, which will be carried out jointly by General MacArthur's Airborne Infantry and the fleet Marines.
That was Joe Hainlein with the 3rd Fleet off Tokyo. Now back to your regularly scheduled programs.
Thank you, Joe Hainlein. The only other big story today is that a fierce tropical hurricane with winds blowing 100 miles an hour is moving inland across Texas just northeast of Corpus Christi. There are no detailed reports as yet. Well, that's the news. And now, while that great armada of Allied warships makes history as it heads into Tokyo Bay, I want to tell you about some forgotten men of the Pacific War. Remember Kwajalein? It's an island in that group of islands called the Marshalls, and it was big news in February of last year when American troops swarmed ashore and sponged up the thousands of Japanese who were defending that bump of rock so far from Tokyo and yet so important in our drive to reach Tokyo. Yes, 18 months ago, Kwajalein was big news, but after we took the place, it became just another forgotten island. Who cared about Kwajalein when Iwo Jima was under fire? Who cared about Kwajalein when Halsey's Third Fleet was stealing the show? Who cared when bombs were landing in the heart of Tokyo? And who cares now about Kwajalein? Kwajalein is ancient history now. Who cares? Well, I can tell you today about several thousand young Americans who don't care a bit for Kwajalein, who wish they'd never heard of the place. They call it a rain-flooded, sun-tortured way station. They call it a paradise for dogs, but a hell on earth for men. They call it a place that would cure any addict of Robert Louis Stevenson's stories, of any romantic ideas he might have about life on a Pacific atoll. They use all the words in a mule driver's vocabulary about the place and wish they knew some more. You see, Kwajalein, shortly after its capture, was converted into another island hopping station in Air Transport Command's Pacific Network. It's just 13 hours by air from Honolulu and 8 hours from Guam. It's an ideal place to refuel and get your plane tuned up on the long hop across the Pacific. If you land there after sitting for 13 hours in a plane's uncomfortable canvas bucket seat, if you land there after looking at nothing but blue water for 13 long hours, then maybe Kwajalein does appear a bit attractive to you. It's land. Any land on a flight like that would appear attractive. But don't let the men who live on Kwajalein hear you express any sentiments like that. The soldiers who are stationed there and who service the planes that come and go feel rather differently about it. In Kwajalein Lodge, the one-room passenger terminal, there's a large blackboard covered with greetings from the permanent residents. They want you to know how they like this place that they call by necessity home. The chalked-up sign reads, "All passengers welcome to Quaj. You too can be rock happy." Another one reads, "This is Kwajalein Atoll. No liquor at all, no women at all, no nothing at all." Still another Chamber of Commerce greeting reads, "Spend a week and go home a freak." The island is only 2.5 miles long and 0.5 mile wide, just large enough to support a few huts, a large runway, and 4 anemic, fruitless palm trees. The soldiers there work 8 hours a day, 7 days a week. They get no passes or weekend leaves because there wouldn't be any place to go if they did get them. They work under a sky that's so hot that even a cigar store Indian would perspire. They live in a uniform which consists only of a pair of shoes, a pair of thin trousers, a pilot's cap, and sun goggles. The tropical sun has burned all of the men a deep chocolate brown. It isn't the work that bothers these Americans. It's the lack of anything else to do. Of course, they can swim, and there is a motion picture projector on the island. And sometimes a plane will drop off a case of pale beer or orangeade. But if you ask one of the old-timers in the island what they do to keep from getting depressed, he'll like as not tell you with a weary tone in his voice, "Oh, we don't do anything to keep from going wacky. Everybody gets rock happy, as we call it, after a couple of months." The men say that the temperature on Kwajalein goes up to at least 120 degrees in the daytime, and that's hot, they say. But it's really the rainy weather that bothers them. Corporal Edward Tomasik of Racine, Wisconsin, who's been there long enough to belong to the local Chamber of Commerce, explains it this way. He says, "When the rain starts coming down, everything floats. You have to walk on water. You need a canoe to get to the mess hall." But there's one thing that does keep up the spirits of those forgotten men. Dogs. Hundreds of dogs. American dogs, fox terriers, chows, a setter or two, poodles, dogs with long flappy ears and dogs with ears that are cut short, thoroughbreds and mutts of indistinguishable breed. Corporal Charles Spade of Hinton, West Virginia, explains how it is that Kwajalein has become an island of dogs. Under Army Air Force regulations, It's all right for combat crews to have dogs as mascots, but when they return from duty in the Far East, they're not allowed to take their dogs any farther than Kwajalein. They're not allowed to take them to Hawaii or beyond. And so they generally fly as far as this, and then there are a few sad moments, a few pats on the head while Rover whines his goodbye, and then the plane flies off, leaving Rover behind. But it works out quite well, for now almost every man on Kwajalein has a dog of his own, and in their loneliness, the men of Kwajalein lavish all kinds of love and affection on those animals that have flown thousands of miles on bombing missions, but now laze away under the tropical sun and help just by their presence to keep several thousand war-weary American mechanics from going completely insane. And that is the story of a forgotten island and some forgotten men who will be awfully glad when this whole nightmare of history is finally over. I'll be back with my favorite story of the day in just a moment, but first a word from your announcer.
American servicemen and women are on the way home. Yes, friends, the troops who fought their way through Africa, Europe, and the islands in the far Pacific, the seamen who put them ashore, and the women's auxiliaries that supported them here at home and abroad, are starting to return to their families. America's victorious forces are beginning to disband. During the next few months, literally millions of soldiers, sailors, and Marines will be traveling across America in crowded trains and buses. Transportation facilities will be strained as never before. And there isn't going to be one extra seat for non-essential civilian travel and gadding about. Those holiday weekends and post-war vacations and all unnecessary visits must be canceled until our fighting men have been returned to their families. So think it over before you travel. Ask yourself this one question. Do I need a railroad or bus seat as badly as a veteran who's been overseas for 2 or 3 years? Well, the answer is obvious, and every thinking American will comply with our government's wishes. Don't travel yet. Stay off crowded trains and buses. Let's give top priority to our returning heroes. And now here again is Robert St. John.
And here is my favorite story of the day. New Yorkers, who get rather hardened to the comedies and the tragedies of life, were a bit shocked last week at a story told in a police court of how an 11-year-old boy, one Paul Blazy, had been beaten by his father, a longshoreman, simply because the boy had spent 50 cents for a watermelon, which he simply couldn't resist. The father knocked the child to the floor, stepped on his neck, beat him with the buckle on the end of a belt. The child was badly cut and bruised. The father was arrested. As the judge set trial for next month, he told the father, "You have lost all right to membership in the human race." Well, most New Yorkers read the story and then turned the page to more pleasant subjects. But not Alan G. Warner, a Fifth Avenue banker who has a son of his own on a submarine chaser in the Pacific. Mr. Warner immediately communicated with the judge, and as a result, 11-year-old Paul Blazy of Brooklyn will next week go to to the banker's home, the home of the banker who loves boys and has a victory garden, and says he needs a hungry boy to help eat up all the food it produces. And so 11-year-old Paul Blazy, today or tomorrow, will put on his best suit of clothes and go out to a big home on Long Island. And there, while he's waiting to testify in court against his own father, he'll learn a bit about what family life can be like. And now this is Robert St. John saying goodbye.
You have been listening to Robert St. John, who will return with another summary of the news and another of his famous stories about people at the same hour tomorrow morning. This is the National Broadcasting Company.
Here is the news from NBC. Each night at 11 o'clock Eastern wartime, we bring you an up-to-the-minute summary of the day's worldwide developments from the NBC newsroom in Chicago. Your reporter is Don Elder. Mr. Elder will be with you in just a moment. But first, a brief message. Do you know someone of whom they say, "He can't see the woods for the trees"? Well, chances are, he lacks a sense of selection. This sense of selection is a good reporter's stock in trade. NBC newsmen have it to a marked degree. As broadcasters, theirs is a problem in selection. They must know how to reject as well as accept. In the brief space of a few minutes, they must report the news that's been hours in the making, hours alive with movement, change, and significance. Like all good reporters, NBC newsmen consider the source of the news, weigh its importance, see each item in relation to the whole. We're proud of the fact that NBC newsmen have such a finely developed sense of selection. It's valuable to them and to you. It's one more reason why an NBC news broadcast is as compact as a K-ration, stripped to the essentials but packed with significance. Now, the news from NBC.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. The well-oiled occupational machinery of the Allies is rolling into high gear tonight. At the moment, more than 10,000 American leathernecks and blue jackets are patrolling the city of Yokosuka, Japan's second largest naval base and the first city to be peacefully invaded by our forces. This first phase of Japan's surrender is being clinched by her leaders, who have spent the evening listening to Marine Brigadier General William Clements instructing them in the proper conduct connected with relinquishing possession of the big naval base. Clements' final order was that the Japanese Vice Admiral of Yokosuka was to go to the main battleship docks, where American Rear Admiral Oscar Badger will take over. Another American naval official, Rear Admiral Robert B. Kearney, has been formally named to accept the surrender of Yokosuka. A few miles on the other side of Tokyo, thousands of airborne forces are swarming over the Japanese countryside after stepping from great transport planes, which are coming in at the Atsugi airfield at the rate of one every 2 minutes. NBC correspondent Merrill Muller broadcast earlier that he was aboard General MacArthur's plane, which at that time was circling over the Atsugi airdrome. There's been no further word that the General's giant silver ship has landed, but quite likely it has done so. And General MacArthur now is probably directing the various stages of the occupation which will follow. Within the next few weeks, thousands of other troops of the 6th and 8th Armies will move in to occupy strategic points of Japan. And now, for further details on the occupation of Japan, we take you first to the NBC newsroom in San Francisco.
We take you now to Japan for a special report from NBC's George Thomas Folster.
This is George Thomas Folster reporting from Japan. We are now at Red Beach, and this just about completes the circuit of the landing of the Marines in the Blue Jacket and the Navy here in Tokyo Harbor this morning. Now, I am reporting, as I said, from the Japanese Naval Air Station located on Natsu, that's N-A-T-S-U, Natsushima, Natsu Island, in other words. And that's north of the Naval Aircraft Arsenal. The Naval Air Station is a base for sea and land planes. And there are 21 or more hangars here, and the taxiways are all laid out so that the hangars may be used interchangeably for other types of planes. Seaplanes used to land in the sheltered area in the northwest sector of the outer harbor here. There is some evidence of bombing. That is a blast more than destruction of any size. Along the shorefront here, for instance, right off to my left, are three hangars which I have not been able to examine closely as yet, but it looks as if they're in a state of construction. Yet just ahead of them is a shambles of junk piled high, which looks as if blast damage had been collected and dumped here. On my way to this point, we passed the bomb-blasted hulk of the Japanese battleship, the Nagato. Now, next to the Hirona, she is the most sunk ship. Well, she is still afloat, but I doubt if she'll even be worth salvage. She is now flying the American flag, and a few hours ago, there were no flags flying in Japan except a few white ones. Now, everywhere you look, the stars and stripes are aloft. After inspecting the Navy Yard and reporting the surrender, we took off on our small boat for Red Beach, for this Naval Air Station. I examined many of the buildings in the Navy Yard, and more about them later. Unlike the old fort where we made the first landing this morning, and where you could see that everything of any value, except ammunition, had been removed, that was not the case here in the Naval Yard. There are huge cranes towering over the buildings. Machine shops are said to be in order. Harbor facilities are excellent. But I am beginning to be convinced in my early wonderment. How could the Japs have ever expected to win this war? They are Bush Reed. Everything I see about me here is Bush Reed. Just off to the left again, by one of the taxiways, is one of those submarines, those suicide submarines. And the very sight of it, its teeny little gun, its torpedo tube, is enough to convince anyone that these toy-like features of Japanese armament was up against a big job. It seems that we were taken by surprise and unpardonably prepared. And let's not let that happen again. Now we'll have our transmitter mounted on a truck, and we're going inland. We're going further inland, away from these beaches, to see what we can report to NBC listeners. This is George Thomas Folster speaking to you from Japan and returning you to the NBC newsroom in San Francisco.
This broadcast by George Thomas Folster came to you from Japan by way of the NBC newsroom in San Francisco.
This is Don Elder once again with more news from NBC. Reaction to the Army-Navy report on Pearl Harbor tonight is varied. Chairman Andrew May of the House Military Affairs Committee has demanded that Major General Walter Short and Rear Admiral Husband Kimmel be given a full, fair, and complete hearing on their part in the Pearl Harbor disaster. May says they should be tried quickly so that they and any others responsible, if guilty, be punished and if innocent, be vindicated. Senator Walsh of Massachusetts, chairman of the Senate Naval Committee, reserved comment until his committee receives a reply from the Navy Department to its request that all the Navy files in regard to the disaster be made public. Representative Short of Missouri is listed among those demanding a court-martial of Admiral Kimmel and General Short. The Missourian further emphasized that Kimmel, Short, and others named in the official reports should be given their day in open court. However, several legislators, including Representative Manasco of Alabama, Representative Sal Bloom of New York, Representative Dingell of Michigan, and Senator Murray of Montana, took issue with criticisms of General of the Army George Marshall and former Secretary of State Cordell Hull in the official reports. Both President Truman and Secretary of War Stimson, you know, also have come out in defense of Hull and Marshall, saying sharply that they believe the criticism leveled at the two is uncalled for. But the bulk report the Army made public today tells a different story. The Army Board charges that Cordell Hull, as the man who knew most of the facts of our standing with the Japanese, didn't keep the Army fully informed and didn't give the armed forces time to get ready for an attack he knew was coming. The Army also claims that General Marshall, knowing of the danger, didn't give the Army all the information he had so that preparations could be made. Admiral Harold Stark and Lieutenant General Giroux are also involved in the charges. Admiral Stark, who was chief of naval operations at the time of Pearl Harbor, is charged with a failure in judgment and also with failing to do the things necessary to prevent disaster. Admiral Kimmel, Pacific Fleet commander at Pearl Harbor, is accused of being equally guilty with Stark. The Army Board also has reaffirmed earlier charges of dereliction of duty against General Short. The report adds that Lieutenant General Giroux, now heading an Army War Study Board in Europe, failed to do his part as chief of the War Plans Division to keep General Short advised of developments with the Japanese and of omitting what the report terms required steps for joint Army-Navy defense in the Pacific. Neither the Army nor the Navy has recommended a court-martial for any of the men involved. As for the six top men involved in the case, only one has made any comment so far. From his home in Dallas, Texas, General Short has issued a signed statement saying, "My conscience is clear." He says at Pearl Harbor, he was obeying instructions from Washington and was acting in accordance with information available to him. Admiral Kimmel and former Secretary Hull have also promised to make statements after they have carefully studied the reports. Admiral Nimitz says he thinks the decision to let the Japanese retain their emperor was a very wise one. At a news conference shortly before the occupation got underway, the top naval officer of the Pacific said he thought the pre-invasion peacefulness was a result of the wisdom of the Potsdam Declaration and the decision to let the emperor stay on his throne. There's been no hostile act, and that, I think, is because of the emperor, he declared. Meanwhile, Nimitz took time out from his occupational duties today to reassure the sailors under him that the Navy will be whittled down to peacetime size as rapidly as possible. He revealed that steps already are underway to get the men started home as fast as ships are made available to carry them. The admiral figures that a peacetime navy of a 500,000 men is about right. Nimitz also confessed to newsmen that he was a little more than 4 months off in his own private guess as to when the war with Japan would end. He said he had the downfall of Japan pegged for the last part of December of this year. The top news from Europe revolves around the Big Four announcement officially naming the 24 ranking Nazis who will face mass trial as war criminals at Nuremberg in October. The list, as was to be expected, covers all the big boys, the cream of the Nazi crop who plunged the world into the worst conflict in history. The list includes such ex-big shots as Hermann Göring, Rudolf Hess, Joachim von Ribbentrop, Robert Ley, Field Marshal Wilhelm Keitel, Colonel General Alfred Jodl, Admiral Karl Dönitz, and Franz von Papen. Those are the outstanding names. But there were two surprises on the list. One was the name of Martin Bormann, deputy leader of the Nazi Party. That's the first concrete indication that Bormann is still alive. There were numerous reports that he had died in the final battle for the Berlin Chancellery along with Adolf Hitler. Another surprise also is the fact that only one German industrialist not connected with the government is listed. It had been expected, you know, that several German industrial leaders who helped Hitler build his war machine would be named. But the only one who will be a defendant in the first mass trial is Gustav Krupp, the senior member of the Krupp armament family. Here's the rest of the official list of the top Nazi war criminals. Alfred Rosenberg, Hans Frank, Ernst Kaltenbrunner, Wilhelm Frick, Julius Streicher, Walter Funk, Hjalmar Schacht, Walter von Schirach, Fritz Sauckel, Albert Speer, Konstantin von Neurath, Arthur Seyss Inquart, Admiral Eric Raeder, and Hans Fritzsche. Back in this country, the pennant hopes of the St. Louis Cardinals were dimmed a bit more today as the seventh-place Cincinnati Reds beat the world champions 3-1, while the league-leading Chicago Cubs blanked the Pittsburgh Pirates 2-0. The Cub victory, combined with the Card loss, gave the Bruins a 4.5-game lead over the Redbirds. In the only other National League game scheduled today, the Brooklyn Dodgers eked out a 2-1 decision over the Philadelphia Phillies. In the only action this afternoon in the American League, the Boston Red Sox whitewashed the New York Yankees 1-0. Tonight, the Washington Senators nosed out the Philadelphia Athletics 3-2 in the first half of a twilight night twin bill. The Senators are leading the second game 1-0 in the fourth. The Detroit Tigers are leading the St. Louis Browns 4-2 in the fourth. The Cleveland Indian-Chicago White Sox game was postponed because of wet grounds. That's the news from NBC. This is Don Elder speaking. Now, your announcer.
Even though the war has ended, it'll be necessary for civilians to forego unessential travel for some time to come. According to present plans, more than 200,000 fighting men a month will be arriving from Europe alone, from now until the end of April 1946. Eventually, men from the Pacific fighting areas will be returning to this country. All will have to be transported from port cities and camps to other camps throughout the country, and ultimately to their homes. This means that anyone who persists in trying to take a pleasure trip of any kind during the several months to come will find it anything but pleasant. In addition, large forces remaining in both the Pacific and European theaters must be provided with shipments of food and material for many months, and large quantities of fuel, grain, foodstuffs, and other essential commodities must be transported within the country to maintain our civilian economy. It's the patriotic obligation of every citizen to make travel space and railway facilities available for essential military and civilian transportation. We can't afford to let our desire to go places interfere with a major transportation job which the railroads still face. The news from NBC is brought to you each night at 11 o'clock Eastern Wartime. Your reporter has been Don Elder. This is the National Broadcasting Company.